Lake Effect returns now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Louis Black is angry a lot of the time, at least in public. For the political comedian, that is part of what people expect of him.
Black's career in comedy is a long one, and it's interwoven with his work in theater. But for many of us, he first gained notice for the rants that have been a regular feature of The Daily Show, first with Jon Stewart and then with Trevor Noah. Younger listeners might recognize him as the voice of the anger character in the animated film Inside Out.
Since his origins in suburban Maryland, then New York City, he has been a staple of the stand-up scene since the 1980s, and that's what brings him to Milwaukee this Friday and Saturday night on his Rant White and Blue tour. We reached him on the line from New York. It is a real pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
So you have made the point in other interviews, and maybe you'll make the point in this interview as well, that the president of the United States is a narcissist. Do you think at some level he's really into this idea that everyone is talking about him at all times?
I don't know if he's, I think he wants it. I don't know the complete pathology of narcissism, except that, you know, I've had friends who've dated narcissists. I have a tendency to date depressives. so I kind of have a sense of what they're like. I mean, it's whether he goes about every day thinking and hoping. I mean, I think he wants them to.
Right.
I think he really wants us to be thinking about him all the time. Otherwise, why would he be doing what he does?
Like it doesn't matter whether people are angry or happy or indifferent, as long as it is all that they are talking about.
Yeah. I mean, there's just no reason for a lot of what he's doing. A lot of what he's doing has nothing to do with being president of the United States. It has to do with directing the focus to him. You know, I mean, it's the same way he operated when he lived in New York. I mean, the one thing that we couldn't get through, we New Yorkers, because most of the United States thinks we're, you know, obnoxious and jackasses, and yet they picked the biggest obnoxious and the biggest jackass to be their president. They didn't listen to us. We lived with him. I mean, I spent 40 years making jokes about this person. From the time I moved to this city, this has been in my face. You know, and now he just has a larger platform for this. And then what I love, my favorite is that people go, you know, what I really like about him is he talks just like me. Well, here's the bottom line. That's the reason you're not the president.
As a topical comedian, are you kind of between a rock and a hard place then? You know, the idea that, you know, what he wants is attention, and at the same time, you can't very well not do Trump material.
Well, I mean, I try not to use his name anymore. So I refer to him as the president or the topic, because I really... And I don't really like talking about him, but you're forced into the position of talking about him, in part, because there's a part of my audience that shows up and really wants me to talk about him. I really make, part of my act is making an attempt never to say his name.
I would think it'd be an interesting challenge to try to do an entire show without any references to him at all.
Well, I could do that. If there's so much going on. You know, I watch CNN for a part of each day because I think it's important, because it gives you a good idea of what it's going to be like when you have a stroke. and what amazes me is how all of this stuff is going off, you know, that he's doing. Meanwhile, on the side, you have the head of the EPA is doing things that are beyond belief. I mean, beyond belief, you have a discussion of healthcare that is completely off the point. You have and none of the news seems to want to go into it or look at it or discuss it or the importance of it. The idea of the EPA is to protect the environment, and you have someone who doesn't believe in protecting the environment. And that's not up for discussion. It's not even up for a discussion.
Do you think it is I was trying to figure out the equation.
And I didn't even get to Betsy DeVos. I mean, so all of that stuff that's occurring on the side is really where there's a lot of comedy. But, I don't have the time to go and dwell on it.
Right, because at some level, people aren't expecting to go in and get 20 minutes of Betsy DeVos.
Right, and also because the news media is leaving it up to me to find the information and leaving it up to the people to find the information so that the setups that I need that will allow me to do the joke aren't there for the people to have access to. But all of the setups are there in terms of Trump. All of them.
I was trying to figure out the equation here. Do you think when you add anger and politics to humor, do you come out with comfort or catharsis, or what is it that makes this intersection work so well and not make people want to walk out of your show with an axe and start smashing stuff up?
Well, partly because a lot of people they're now more there's more blowback than there was before. And so that it isn't working as well. Part of it is that I think people always say I'm saying stuff that they would like to say. So there's a catharsis to the fact that, well, if somebody said it good, I can move on. And also knowing that there's, if the joke, when the jokes come through, because I don't think I'm being that funny in this interview, but it really is like part of doing my interviews now is getting this out of my system so I can go be funny again. None of this is a shock. We've been through it on one level or another since I was born. But it's just become in the last, 20 some odd years, that it really is revved up. I mean, it was batshit. It was out of control when I was in college. In the 60s.
I was trying to imagine Louis Black in 1968, actually.
Yeah, I was crazy. But I wasn't crazy enough to go, I'm going to go blow up things, or I'm going to go do this, or I'm going to go do that. I was trying to write plays. That's how, I was. But in the midst of it, I also was, writing some humor about it.
I was trying to figure this out because I'm a little younger than you. I grew up in the 70s and 80s, but in the late 60s, was there ever a sense? Could you see the light at the end of the tunnel that this was things were going to be different? 5, 6, 7, 8 years down the road. I mean, I think that's one of the things that's at play now is that people can't really imagine, what comes next.
Well, partly because we're going through a shift, and we went through a shift then. But the shift then wasn't as big as the shift now. This is a huge shift now because we're going essentially from a kind of industrial age, if you will, to a technological age. So we're going to, or an information age, whatever they want to call it.
Right.
So where there was kind of like the minor opening up of a culture in terms of hallucinogens. there's been the same in essence. I feel repetition of it in terms of the equivalent of the hallucinogen is your smartphone or then the internet and the computer, which are extensions of your nervous system, and it was just dropped. We just dropped it on ourselves and said, hey, okay, we'll figure it out, They took away LSD immediately, but this they didn't kind of roll it out slowly and say, "Hey, maybe we should talk about what all this means. Let's just do it." And what the result has been is staggering, in terms of its effect on a culture. But nobody cares. Nobody cares. So the people are driving down the street. And all of a sudden, they're literally somehow a text is more important than the traffic that they're in. Is anybody home?
I had this down in my notes, the idea that we're sort of in this really addictive mentality, and it could be texts or it could be CNN and Fox and MSNBC on every place. I mean, places that I'm surprised that when I go to pick up my fourth grader at school, there's not a TV on with a crawl at the bottom of it in his classroom.
Yeah, what's coming? I mean, it was really what was funny was there was a time there before between. In the early 90s, late 80s, there was a time when before the internet and the computer age kind of exploded, that I was approached by folks to do stuff for colleges, you know, for television at colleges, and there was going to be televisions in schools, you know, in elementary schools,
right,
and high
right.
schools. And now, of course, if you watch the ads, you don't even have to send your kid to school because they can learn on the computer. I mean, what? I mean, seriously. You know, I mean, my feeling is when, you know, people always go, well, what do you think is the most important thing? I think public education. And I think that my generation dropped the ball on that.
Just in keeping it on the agenda?
Yeah, how tough was that? It was there. I had a great, I mean, you know, we talked about it. We were both raised in the same county. I
yep.
had one of the best educations you could possibly have.
Absolutely.
And it wasn't an overly wealthy county at that point. There was just a solid group of people who wanted to teach. And then they tried to succeed, and that somehow it couldn't be sustained over time because adults... What did the adults start caring more about whether their kid got a soccer scholarship rather than what was going on in the classroom? I don't know. But I find it baffling. Much the same way my generation, which was schooled in a war that everybody knew at the end of time, maybe we shouldn't have gone into, and in which tragically those who fought in it were not treated the way they should have been after the war, then you start one. Then my generation, with that lesson, you know, it goes, well, you know, the other war took place in a jungle, but this time it's in a desert, so it's different. So we end up going, we take none of the lessons from the Vietnam War, none of them, and go into Iraq. What? It really is beyond disturbing. And I knew it was going to happen. That's what really irritated me. More than anything else, it was like I've never been right about anything. But that I was right about. I watched. I said, they're going to do this. This same group of idiots. And they did. The group of people who should have learned the lesson didn't learn the lesson. And a lot of it had to do because they weren't in uniform.
It does seem like a lot of times these days in this business, the news business anyway, my end of the business, that you could almost write the stories about a year or 2 years or 5 years before they happen.
Yeah. It really does. They don't even, and what's really amazing is you could do that, and they don't do about, they can't even get a grip on what happened today.
Right. Well, and the shelf life of your material, speaking of which, has to be a lot shorter than it was because, you know, we're talking on a day, you know, the day after Monfort and Gates are arrested, but who knows what it's going to look like tomorrow or the next day or the next week.
Yeah, and then they popped today was Papadopoulos Day, which is really great because, I mean, wow, that one slipped by everybody. And then, oh, and excuse us, here's another one. And there's something about it that just is eerily like Watergate. I know that people don't want to hear that, but it's weird. You know, there's just a weirdness to it that is reminiscent. It may not be. Is the jury still out for me? Yeah. But there's, you know, because I don't think that the problem is Russia. I think there's other stuff in terms of his financial dealings, they just kind of ignored. You can't fly your Secret Service people to a Trump villa or whatever, a hotel, where he's going to play golf, and then charge the people, you know, your high rate. I mean, you just, come on. There's got to be something that's not really legit about it. But he's a great businessman. Yeah, at government expense. It's really like my head spins.
Well, right, and I would imagine at this point, you know, all of the Scaramucci material is obsolete.
Oh, it's completely gone. It's really too bad. There's a really great. My friend Mario Cantone is a very funny comedian. literally could do Scaramouche. I mean, he literally went on the air immediately as Scaramouche and could have, as soon as he saw him, knew, and he's, because it's right out of his act, practically, this guy, like a cousin of his. And it was like, I went, this is great, because, I mean, Mario's known for Sex and the City and a few things, but it was like, oh, boy, this is really a great card for him to play. And then 3 days later, it was gone.
It's like having William Henry Harrison material, and then he's dead.
Yeah.
Political comedians in, what, 1848 or whenever that was. I want to ask you a quick question about how your comedy work relates to your work in the theater. I guess the question I had, because most people, you know, in the business would have done stand up and then maybe gone into the theater, and you went the other way. And at some level, you're still doing both. Did they scratch different itches for you?
Well, they're kind of the same because what it allowed me initially to do was. Because I didn't think this would ever be a career, because I never felt that comfortable on stage for a long time. And so, but what it allowed me to do was write and get the writing out there. And that was what it was really about. And then it was kind of like, wow, if I had a choice, would I pick me to be the person getting the writing out? No, I'd get a really good actor. So, you know, and we did. It's kind of like, so it does, it really was a completely, it was really by accident that this all occurred, you know, because really it was, you know, my transition took place while I was working in a room in New York City where we were trying to really, where all of us, the three of us who were running it, were theater people and wanted to get our theater stuff done and wanted to, you know, Rusty was writing music. I was writing plays. My friend wanted to direct. That was what we wanted to do. And that, so what I was doing, meanwhile, was becoming more comfortable on stage. Promoting, because each before each show, I would talk about what was coming up and who was in the show and the writers, et cetera. And we were doing two new one acts a week. So I mean. Nobody before or since has done as many one-act plays, I don't believe, as we did in the course of 9 years.
Wow.
To the interest of no one, except the theater community.
And those of us listening today, however many years later.
Yeah.
Do you think the audience, you know, I guess the question I was wondering as I was thinking about, you know, the experience you have as an audience member when you go into the theater versus when you go into a comedy show, is there a certain, you know, suspension of the world around you that takes place when you're there for that, you know, hour or 90 minutes or 2 hours that's similar, do you think?
Well, one is, I think that, yes, there is. One thing that is different for sure is if you go in, going into a comedy club is way different from going into a theater to watch a comic work. Whether it's me or Bill Burr or Patton Oswalt, Jim Gaffigan, Kathleen Madigan, because you're in a theater. And so all of a sudden there's a whole different, using the word, vibe mm-hmm. to the place. There's a level of silence. You don't have people wandering in and out with chicken wings. you're not fighting for the attention of the audience. You have full attention. But the difference between doing even that, and they kind of come with an idea, okay, I'm going to come in, we're going to listen to this person spin, you know, is basically kind of in its most primitive sense, it's a storytelling. But when you do theater, you have to get all of those people to not only suspend their disbelief, but to join in on saying, okay, we are going to buy into this reality that's being created on stage, which is what fascinated me about theater to begin with.
Sure.
I just thought that was the hook for me. It's like, wow, there was something about it that was, I mean, it was in, you use the word, it's, you know, it's, there was, I mean, it's, that's why it's always been hooked up with religion or spirituality or whatever, you know, yada, yada. Okay. I get it. We'll talk about that some other time, but it is a group of people who are really do sustain a reality together. In the same way, if you go to church, you sustain. We are all here because we believe in God. And we all believe, you know, when we go into the theater, we all believe that, that Willie Loman really is, in that hotel room. We buy it.
Well, so these many years later, when you are on a stage and you're, you know, channeling your anger at the world in a funny way, is it? I mean, maybe this is the most obvious question in the world, but there must be still a certain magic that comes out of, you know, making a room full of 1,000 people laugh.
Oh, yeah. You know, and there's still a certain sense of, I can't believe they're laughing. I mean, I've said it time and again. I go, wow. You know, people say, you know, for a while I was wandering around when I was doing the acting going, you know, I say things and people laugh, and you know, and I know that there are those about of you out there who aren't laughing because you don't think it's funny. And I said, you know what? I agree with you.
Do you walk off the stage and after, you know, after 90 minutes or whatever and just say, well, I guess I fooled him again?
Well, no, there's, you know, I mean, part of me, of course, always thinks it's not that I fool them again, that there'll be somebody there who'll go, okay, enough's enough. We're going to have to take you someplace for quiet time. That's really what I think. I feel like I'm lucky. I've been blessed, you know, be able to kind of do this. I mean, it's kind of, and it's great because essentially what I've done is, there is an audience that's out there. A lot of people don't get it. I get that they don't get it because what I'm really doing, a lot of the times, most of my act is I'm writing on stage. I have an audience that allows me to write in front of them. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That they are, you know, and of course I better, you know, you can't really get away with that unless you kind of go, okay, here's a joke. Now I'm going to work again. And here's a joke, and that if you know, so it's been really great in that sense. And the other is that I've been able to now, after every show, I do this live stream. It's really a TV show that ends up. You can watch it on your phone or on the computer, or, you know, the way you watch, you know, a streaming TV show.
Hopefully not while you're driving.
Not while you're driving. But after every show, so when I'm in Milwaukee, after the show, the show will end, and then my opening act will prep the audience, and then I read questions that the audience have sent in. They can send them in that night. They're given a place to go to, or they can do it before I even arrive in town. And then they can write rants. And I'm, you know, and I hope that I keep trying to push now because it's been a slow evolution. And now I realize too, you know, if I'm coming to Milwaukee, if something about Milwaukee really, you know, if you've got a rant about Milwaukee, send it in. If it's funny and I like it, you know, I'll read it. And it's been remarkable. There's been a group of people who have written spectacularly.
Well, and there was a time, I mean, you know, you've been doing this long enough, that you were performing at a time when people, you know, didn't have their heads buried in smartphones, but also it would have been a lot harder to have that dialogue with your audience.
Yeah. And now I do, and if, as long as I've got, you know, that to me is at least a healthy way. You know, and it also gives them an opportunity to get stuff off their chest. And there's been a group of people who go, well, how come you know you go? How come you're not doing your stuff? I do a 60-minute show. Then I answer questions. Then I'm basically doing what I do on TV when I read something on The Daily Show, or if I'm on some other show where they've given me something to read out of the teleprompter. I mean, come on. So what I've done is actually instead of hiring a team of writers, I've asked people, you know, who to write. And what's occurred is there have been people who've been writing for me who've become fairly proficient at writing and have gone on to write other things. So I feel really good about it. So, yeah, am I going to make an apology to you because I'm helping, you know, because I'm helping someone kind of get something off their chest? No. And I'm performing it, schmuck.
Well, you know, and it also speaks to something else that I have noticed, which is this belief that some people have that everybody should like everything at all times. You know, it's like music or comedy or books or whatever. You know, there seems to be a disbelief that some people could like something and some people could not like something, and that's okay.
Right. Absolutely.
We've lost our ability to, you know, we don't need consensus. What we need consensus about is that we don't need consensus.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and that we have so many people at this point that something that I believe way, way back was that you could have, you know, you could have 300,000 people across the United States who really liked a certain kind of theater or a certain kind of film or a certain kind of whatever, and basically could, you know, dial into it and support a group of people who were doing that. You know,
yeah.
we've certainly done it in terms of the porn industry.
I'm a little afraid of the road we're going to go down now.
No, but no, I mean, it's just, but it's true. I mean, you know, you get enough people and they want to see something. Now it's, you know, you know, I mean, that was it. That's what, you know, Netflix is based on it. You know, everybody throw in $10 and look at what we can get.
Right, right. Well, listen, Lewis Black, it's been a thrill to chat with you, and yeah, really looking forward to having you in Milwaukee, and I hope we can talk again down the road.
I hope so. It was really a pleasure, and I always look forward to coming to Wisconsin.
Comedian Lewis Black performs in Milwaukee Friday and Saturday night at the Pabst Theater. We reached him at his home in New York. I want them to